Vicar Alfriel 2.
Yes, I was talking about the skill of the operators. And even where a big echo was being received from a mountain, the operators could tell if there were aircraft coming through as well, because they got a beating echo. And a good operator could even estimate roughly the number of aircraft involved. And of course, at later stage, our aircraft used to carry what was called IFF, Identification Friend or Foe, I think it stood for. And they could pick out what aircraft were ours and what were the enemies.
Were you ever involved with IFF?
Not directly, no. It was just a unit that was put in the aircraft. It, any radar stations could pick it up. And when it got back to the airfield, radar mechanics would check it and make sure that it worked okay.
Was this a good time or a bad time for you at Worth Travers?
It was a good time.
Despite
very
the
good
air
time,
raids?
I would say.
Despite the air raids?
Oh, they were minor by comparison, to what had happened in southeast London. But certainly, Swanage, where we were billeted, hardly suffered at all. I think they'd had a bomb on the beach once, but not much else, as far as I could gather.
What are your next memories?
The next memory, of course, was being posted overseas. And the posting was to West Africa. And it started in an interesting way straight away, because we were quite a small party of RAF, and we were put on the armed merchant cruiser, the Ranpura. It was sister ship to the Royal Pindi, which I believe I got the name right. It had a sort of honourable end. It went down with its 6-inch guns blazing earlier in the war. And the Royal Pindi was, the Ranpura, was similarly armed. And it felt rather good to be on this armed merchant cruiser, with the Navy at the ready. And we travelled out as a part of the convoy to Freetown.
From where?
From Liverpool.
What was that voyage like?
We had alarms and things happening on the outskirts, but we never had a U-boat pack among us. But we, when we landed, we were told that an earlier draft had in fact been torpedoed. In fact, they were known as the torpedoed draft, and they were due to go home a bit early in compensation. But it never happened to us. I can remember now, though, at night, with all these bunks, down low in, probably down as far as the waterline, just a blue light on and the creaking of the hammocks, and the throb of the engines, and wondering all the time if you're going to get a torpedo slammed into you, was quite a strange thought.
Where did you disembark?
We didn't disembark. We went to Freetown and then reassembled for another convoy going along the West African coast. And from there, we went to Takoradi. Takoradi in what is now Ghana. It was the Gold Coast then. And we were told cheerfully that it was known as the white man's grave. And there was certainly a problem with malaria and other things too. And when we got to Takoradi, again I was put on a mobile, it wasn't a mobile, but it was a CH station. And this time our towers that carried the rays were, I believe they were made of yarra wood. I think it came from Australia, if I remember rightly. And very solid towers to, stand up against the typhoons that were likely to hit it. And there I spent quite some time working on this unit. And the reason that this station had been put up there was the threat from the French colonies. Our colonies were surrounded by French colonies. And this was at the time of Vichy France. And I think it was Admiral Darlin in the Mediterranean to the north. And we were afraid all the time that the Luftwaffe were going to appear in the French colonies and Takoradi was going to get bombed. And the reason for that was that the RAF had set up a big assembly base at the airfield at Takoradi, and aircraft were brought out by boat in crates from both the USA and from the UK, and they were assembled by RAF mechanics with native help at Takoradi. And our job in this radar station, which wasn't on the airfield, it was quite a distance away on higher ground, and it was our job to keep a watch for any hostile aircraft coming from the north, and also to look out at sea as well if anything should come from that direction. And that job went on for quite some time, but then eventually the threat of the colonies going over to Vichy died away, and the Free French emerged supreme in North Africa, and so there was no need then for our radar station at Takoradi. So the operators were flown home, and the mechanics were told we had to stay. And you know, we all looked a bit amazed and disappointed, as you can imagine. But eventually we learnt what we were going to do. A 26 South African Air Force squadron had arrived at Takoradi, and at the same time they took over. They'd previously been north, and they'd been flying twin-engined American aircraft, I forget what they were called now, but they were now taking over Wellingtons of the RAF. And these Wellingtons, they were very unusually camouflaged, it seemed to us, who Wellingtons always were in, you know, green and khaki or whatever it was. But these were in blue and white for the South Atlantic. And the bomb racks had been removed, and instead the bays had been filled with depth charges. And along the back of the aircraft, there were aerial arrays, like a stickleback approach. And under the wings, there were two. Under each wing there was a directional aerial, and this was the radar gear that we were going to have to learn about, and we were given the secret documents, and of course the basic theory was the same. And they had some personnel. They had a couple of officers and a sergeant, but they had no other mechanics at all. So, you know, I don't know if this had been planned in advance in some way, or if it was just fortuitous that there were these RAF mechanics there. And about half of our number were Canadians, actually. So they were RCAF, attached to RAF, attached to SAF, South African Air Force. And it was rather strange that, you know, there were so many of us involved, like a minor league of nations, you know, in running this operation. And anyway, of course, we had to be very close related with what happened in the air, besides having a radar shack where we could do the servicing and repairs. And we worked on these units. It was, I think it was called ASV, but air surface vessels, possibly. I'm not too sure about that, but anyway, you know, the idea was that the aircraft, with its broad band, it flew towards the sighting of the submarine, and if it veered either to the right or to the left, it got the signal varying. There was a vertical trace, and it got bigger to the right or bigger to the left according to which way that they were going. And then when they got close in, they used the aerials that gave them an absolute homing in on the U-boat, and then dropped their depth charges. And as I say, it was our job to service this, and we used to go up, of course, with the aircraft frequently to make sure it was working. But besides that, we actually went out on short patrols as well. And I remember one of our number went down to Pointe Noire in the Belgian Congo, where apparently the South African Air Force had a detachment, and We were all hoping to get on that, but it never happened for any of us, only the one. And he was one of the Canadians. And eventually it came to the time to return.
What kind of living conditions were you under in Takoradi?
We were billeted where the airfield personnel were billeted as well. And we had bungalows, long bungalows, and they had mosquito netting on the outside. And inside we had beds with mosquito nets. So it was a sort of double protection. But there were all sorts of strange things happened. We used to get off watch very late at night and only sort of dim lights, and other watches were sleeping. And I remember I'd left a sandwich on a plate covered by a saucer to eat when I got back off watch. And I restored my sandwich and started eating it, and my hand felt very ticklish, and I sort of put my torch on and had a look. And I found I was eating a sandwich infested with red ants, you know. God knows how many I'd eaten. I put the sandwich down pretty hastily. And we used to be plagued with rats as well. And these rats used to go up the outside mosquito netting and get under the eaves, into the roof. They'd got it down to a fine art. And then at night when the lights were out and all was quiet, they used to come down into the place where we slept. We were under these mosquito nets, but, you know, it was quite commonplace to wake up and find a rat in the top of your net. They were sort of rectangular nets, not the tent type. They were rectangular, and there's nothing to find a rat on the top netting of these things. And, you know, there seemed to be rats everywhere. And I witnessed the natives cooking these giant rats over a fire and then eating them.
Did they offer you any?
I think they would gladly have given us a taste if we'd asked, but nobody did, you can be sure.
How did you get on with the local people?
Good chop, they used to say, you know. Very well indeed. In fact, there was a native boy, he was a Mohammedan from the north of the Gold Coast. He was one of the Hausa tribe, and his name was Solofu Moshi, as I recall. And he became my helpmate because, again, I fell for what was called the job of being the aerial Joe. It was my job, you know, to see everything went right up the mast. There were various relays to check, you know, because on this particular type of CH apparatus, you put aerials in that acted as reflectors so you get a stronger signal in one direction. You knew that was the direction the aircraft was coming from, the front and not from the back. And, you know, all these things had apparatus up the mast, and we had to go up and service it. And Salu was very, very useful to me. He was really able up the mast, you know, tremendously agile, far more than I was. We had safety belts, and we used to use these safety belts. You sort of buckled the safety belt round the mast, and you sat out in the belt, in the other part of the belt, you know, with the outer belt going round you, round the mast. And there you know, worked at whatever you had to. And he would hand me whatever I needed. He quickly learnt what I did need from the box, you know. And we really established a good rapport. I suppose he was about 15, Salo. And it was rather touching, really. When it came for my time to go home, he said to me, they called us Massa. And he said, Massa, he said, I give you money so you can buy me bicycle to send to, you know, Gold Coast. And of course, I couldn't do any such thing in wartime, and I had to tell him it just wasn't possible, you know, but I gladly would have done. And he lived in Secondy, which was very close to Takoradi. And I never knew what his address was, you know, but I wish I had it, and I wish I'd written to him, you know, and tracked him down. But he was a good lad, was Salo. I hope he's still alive.
Any other memories from Gold Coast before you leave it?
No, I can't think of any just at the moment. We travelled back to Freetown on a rather surprising boat once again. It was called the Dumana, as I recall, and it had been a vessel on the Great Lakes in Canada, and apparently it had fairly shallow draft and wasn't too good, you know, in a rough sea. But fortunately for us, we didn't get too rough a sea going up the coast, but the only escort we had was a corvette, and I know from, you know, the experience of the South African Air Force squadron, there were still U-boats about, and we did feel a bit vulnerable. But this Dumana was actually a WT wireless telegraphy fitting station for the RAF, and it had been in the Indian Ocean, and there were lots of photographs of near misses that they had in the Indian Ocean, setting up, you know, WT stations in very isolated places. And it was going back to Freetown, and they had just called in to pick us up. There were only a few of us. And the captain was, oh, I don't know, a squadron leader or a wing commander. I know, I don't know if he'd merit a wing commander, probably a squadron leader. And everything was different from the Navy, but they seemed to know thoroughly what they were doing. They must have been sailors beforehand, I would think, but they just didn't do it Navy fashion, you know, and it was all rather a surprise and all rather sort of easy going, I felt, after the Navy, you know. They had good rations, though. They had American rations, and so it was really quite a pleasant little trip back to Freetown. I've often wondered what happened to the Dumana. At this stage, I recall that I added it up once, and I spent over 3 months of my RAF career afloat, you know, on one boat or another. And later, it included a Dutch liner, the Christian Huygens, and a French liner, the Ville d'Orane, and an Italian destroyer. I forget the name of that. That was one of their famous men, but I can't remember who it was now. And that at that time was plying between Malta and Sicily. And it was one of the occasions when I went to Sicily and came back on this particular Italian destroyer.
So you returned to England via Freetown?
Yeah, that's right. And once back in England, I was sent to Canewdon. Canewdon is north of Southend. And we always travelled down from London under our own steam, you know, if we'd been home on a leave. And it was on one of those occasions, going back to Canewdon, there'd been a serious explosion somewhere on the line. I forget where it was exactly. I know the line included Rayleigh and Rochford, but I've got a feeling it was a bit further back than that on that line. And anyway, the story was that it was some new weapon the Germans had, a flying bomb. It hadn't been released, the information generally. I was just told this, you know, when I got back to the RAF station. And sure enough, it was a flying bomb, because it wasn't long, of course, because the flying bombs were coming over in earnest. And it was at the time, of course, of D-Day then. And in a way, I suppose it was the Germans, one of the Germans' ways of trying to slow things up for the invasion. And huge numbers of aircraft were flying over then. And I remember that eventually the station became care and maintenance, which meant the mechanics had to stay on. And there were other units, other radar units on the site. I think they were 5K and 7K units, which were navigational units. When we sent out these huge bomber raids, you know, they flew on these navigational beams, and that's what they were doing at Canewdon. And we stood by in case attention, you know, should come back on Canewdon, because, you know, the Germans, I think, were far too preoccupied then with the invasion to, and also Russia, to think about, you know, resuming the kind of raids that we'd had before. And one thing we used to do, which was highly reprehensible, really, when there were these flying bomber raids, We'd had a few at the local, those of us, we carried on watches just the same. This was the ones who were off duty. And off duty, we used to go up our towers to one of the high platforms to watch these flying bombs, you know. And sometimes it seemed the flying bombs were no higher than the tower, you know. And at the same time, you know, I suppose with one or two bitters inside us, it gave us sort of false courage to indulge this pastime. Anyway, it didn't last for long. I fully expected, as many of my friends in radar had done, to be posted to a mobile along with the invasion, or shortly after. But it never came for me. Instead of that, I was posted out to the Mediterranean, to Naples. Of course, a really serious war was going on there when I arrived. You know, I think perhaps an unsung war to many. You know, the New Zealanders and the British and American fought a very, very tough, hard battle up the spine of Italy. And when I arrived in Italy, they just cleared Naples. In fact, to such an extent that to go ashore, we had to cross sunken boats. And between them, there were gangways. And we walked across these sunken boats and the gangways to get to land. And we were then billeted, I remember, at a place called Portici, just down the coast, outside Naples. And as a temporary job, while they were sorting us out, I was sent to the aircrew transit office. And I found the man in charge, well, there was an RAF general duties, but the one who actually ran all the serious stuff was, again, a radar mechanic who got lost, who liked where he was and was quite happy to stay quiet for as long as he could, you know. And anyway, we ran this office, and one side of it was very sad because there were men coming in, aircrew, and I might say at this moment that my number, 1337850, was given to me at the aircrew selection board at Weston-super-Mare, and there were others, you know, of the roundabout number who passed through Weston-super-Mare that I heard of and read of, you know, in the Gazette and wherever, who'd, you know, never survived. But these men coming into this transit place, a lot of them were being busted down, as they called it. And of course, they all had rank, flight sergeants mostly. And they'd done, you know, tours of duties. They were not just, you know, inexperienced people, but at last it had got to them. And they'd, you know, got to just severe stress that they couldn't operate any longer. But of course, in wartime, although in the First World War, I mean, such unfortunates often faced a firing squad, as we know. But in the RAF, certainly, and certainly in the Army, too, there was nothing of that in the Second World War. But they didn't get very gentle treatment. And I remember in this office, they had their documents stamped LMF. And LMF stood for lack of moral fibre. And it meant that they were, you know, lost their rank and were put straight into RAF Group 5 general duties, which I felt was, you know, a terrible thing for them, you know, and quite unjustified. And many of them told me, you know, the experiences that they'd had, and to think that men of that calibre, you know, should have suffered this.
What type of things did they tell you?
Well, some of them were night fighter crews, you know, they flew, what were they? The night fighters, they'd have probably been bow fighters or mosquitoes, you know, just a crew of two. And they had pretty horrible experiences, and some of them had been in bomber crews and, you know, whatever. And of course, some of the people passing through, it was just, you know, as I say, just a transit centre. But every now and again, you got these ones that were branded in this way.
So even at the time, you felt sympathetic to them?
Oh, yes, indeed, because, you know, I hoped to fly myself, and there, but for the grace of God, you know. the flying that I'd done was all fun, you know, in West Africa. And voluntary, what's more, you know.
So you said you were billeted at Portici.
Hmm.
And then?
Now, Portici, while we were there, we were able to hitch lifts on the Autostrada, and I remember going down to the name of the place, you know, that in the
Sorrento?
Volcano. Sorrento, yes, but where, you know,
Salerno?
It was buried. Where it was buried, you know?
Pompeii?
Pompeii. Went down to Pompeii. And that was a wonderful experience, you know, to be able to go there. And all thanks to the United States transport, because along the Autostrada, which passed close by, there are all these American transports. And if you wore an American or a British uniform, they always stopped and gave you a lift. So, you know, if you were given some leave, you only had to get out on the Autostrada and thrum a lift, and you could go down, I think they called it the Amalfi Road, you know, and very pleasant that was too. Anyway, this didn't last very long at Portici. I've been back there since with my wife before she died, you know, we were able to go there and see Portici. It's all built on now with blocks of flats and goodness knows what. But we were, Vesuvius had recently erupted, and we were in pup tents originally there. These were American pup tents, very low to the ground, and we were on volcanic ash, and it got into everything, you know, your hair and your cooking utensils and everything, you know, all your gear and clothing. But we were then moved into a villa, and it was a bit better there. It was getting cold, I remember, because there was no heating in the villa. And but nevertheless, it was better than being in a pup tent on Vesuvius stuff. But then, surprise, surprise, I expected to go north, but instead of that, I was posted south to Malta. And Malta's role still hadn't finished, of course. I don't know if I mentioned, but the, of course, the Montgomery's war, the reason for Takoradi was to fly these crated aircraft across Africa, right up country, you know, North Africa and onwards. And there were staging posts had been set up just, you know, virtually just to pick up petrol. And one twin engine plane flew for a major part of the navigation, accompanied by five or six single engine aircraft. And they went right up to Egypt to, you know, back up the Air Force that was flying with Montgomery. And of course, I can't remember at that stage when I arrived in Malta if it was still, you know, being raided from North Africa or from Italy. I don't think it was. But anyway, the station I was first in was close in at Valletta. But then I was moved out to a station that was further out from Valletta. It was on the way to St. Paul's Bay. And where we were billeted was down on the coast in an encampment there. But our station was, I think it was called, it had been Fort Maddalena up in where there were farms. You know, and there were the remains of these farms where we had our radar station. It was all, what do you call the kind of farming where it's in layers up the hillside?
Terraced.
Terraced, yeah. And it was all terraced there, and our radar station was on one of these terraces. And I remember there was a fig tree actually growing on the technical site with beautiful ripe figs, and nobody was interested except me, and, you know, can't eat too many ripe figs, of course, but, you know, I said to the others, you know, these are a real delicacy. Buy them in Waltons in London and they cost you a bomb. But nobody wanted to know. And similarly with the grapes growing on the terraces as well, you know, ripe grapes that nobody wanted. They were, you know, interested in anything but what grew on the terraces. But anyway, there we had our radar. And it was a CHL this time, chain home low. In other words, our job was to pick up low-flying aircraft and shipping. And there was the trace there, I had a photograph of it. In fact, I hope I still have it. I've got some old photographs somewhere, and we moved into this house, and I found them once, but now I've lost them again, and I've made a search.